Now, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce tonight's guest speaker, Dr. Ephraim Steinberg. Dr. Steinberg is professor of physics at the University of Toronto, where he is a founding member of the Center for Quantum Information and Quantum Control. He obtained his Bachelor of Science at Yale, spent a year working with future Nobel laureate Serge Haroche in Paris before moving to Berkeley to conduct a PhD with Ray Chow, where he carried out a measurement of the seemingly faster-than-light single-photon tunneling time. Dr. Steinberg then learned the ropes of laser cooling in the group led by Elizabeth Jacobino at the University of Paris and in the lab of another Nobelist, Bill Phillips, at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Maryland before taking up his position in Toronto in 1996. He is a fellow of the American Physical Society, the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, and he is an affiliate member of Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario. His 2011 experiment measuring average trajectories for photons in a two-split interferometer was selected by Physics World magazine as the breakthrough of the year. So now, please welcome to the stage Dr. Steinberg, who will share some of his new ideas revolutionizing our view of quantum measurement. Dr. Steinberg. Thank you.
Well, good evening. Thank you very much for coming. It's amazing to see this audience out there. I've had the pleasure of coming to one or two talks in this venue before, and I'm always blown away by them, and it's quite an honor and a privilege to be able to be among you tonight. Let me just say a few words about my title slide before I launch into the talk itself. This title, In Praise of Weakness, may seem a little strange. And the thing is that I've been very excited over the past few years by something called weak measurement, a new strategy. Now, the thing is, there'd be no reason to call it weak measurement if we weren't contrasting it with something else, some other kind of measurement. So, in fact, what I want to do is spend much of my time just trying to describe the situation in quantum measurement theory and what the problems are in quantum mechanics thinking about measurement and why we had to go to this idea of measuring things more weakly. And as I do that, some of it will maybe seem a little bit abstract. I'm going to go back to things that puzzled the founders of quantum mechanics and still puzzle most of us today. And that's why, in the back of my mind, I always want to keep a picture of what we really mean by a quantum measurement. And I have lots of textbooks that have mathematical descriptions of quantum measurements, and we've done quantum measurements, but in the end, to me, nothing better encapsulates it than this photograph here, which is actually of a person, that's Chris Helmerson, then at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, staring at a little glowing cloud over here that's about 100 million trapped sodium atoms, just held in the middle of the vacuum, trapped and cooled by laser beams. And one of the major points that I'd like to get across is that while quantum measurement has been a puzzle that physicists and later on philosophers, after the physicists got tired and didn't get anywhere, have argued about since about 1926, it's something that when I was a grad student, it was a little bit taboo. It was considered okay to talk about when you retired, or at least when you got tenure, but sort of in bad form to talk about it before you had a permanent job. It might really be bad for the health. And that's changed. And it's changed for a number of reasons, and it's something I think we should all appreciate. Some of it is due to new theoretical ideas that suggest that these questions are of practical importance. When we try to build quantum computers and quantum cryptographic systems, we need to understand these things better than we needed to when we were just trying to build transistors in classical computers. We needed some of the rules of quantum mechanics for that, but maybe not the same abstruse questions that we're worrying about now. But from an experimental point of view, and I'm an experimentalist, what's even more important is the technology has advanced. We are capable of doing things today, like trapping sodium atoms, controlling their quantum state, measuring what's going on. And these issues of what is a quantum measurement become relevant in the actual experiments that we can do. And that's something that's really had an extremely rapid growth over, let's say, the last 20 years, to the point that there are half a dozen or more different kinds of platforms, architectures, where one can really study individual quantum systems. And that was not true throughout most of the 20th century. So for those of you who aren't really familiar with thinking about quantum measurement, I did realize a few years ago that it had finally reached the true popular stage when I just happened to be in some cafe, picked up a free newspaper, opened to the cartoon page, And I saw this cartoon. It said, scientists discover media has quantum effect on reality. A team of quantum physicists has discovered that an electron's existence is in an uncertain state with no actual location until it is reported on by the media, and not just some, you know, minor channel. It wasn't quite this cartoon. I think in the original it said Princeton. I had to change that to Toronto out of some kind of loyalty. But this is the kind of thing that we hear. Quantum mechanics is well known among, let's say, broader intellectuals and people who read about science for what it's done to the role of the observer, saying that we can't discuss reality without talking about what we choose to observe, what we choose to measure. And that's a very slippery slope. I want to be a little careful about that. So I want to spend some time explaining where those ideas come from, but I'll leave you with some open, nagging questions about how true it is. Okay, but that's sort of the starting point. So where will we go from the starting point? I want to begin by giving you this historical background, talking about orthodox quantum theory and why it has such a funny attitude towards reality as opposed to observation, and then move into observation itself, what it means to do a measurement, the uncertainty principle that you've all heard about, and a related principle known as the complementarity principle. And this introduces the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, or EPR paradox, which many of you have heard of, related to these ideas of quantum entanglement that we all like to talk about these days. I don't really want to spend a lot of time talking about EPR, but I can't resist giving at least some description of it when I talk to a general audience about quantum mechanics. This paradox led to what I think is either the major or one of the two major intellectual steps of the 20th century in all fields of human endeavor. And more or less, what it suggests is that uncertainty may be an intrinsic property of nature. And that's still a debatable question, but I'll try to explain why we think it seems to imply that. And from there, I'll move on to this idea of weak measurement that I'm so interested in these days, which I like to think of as a kind of quantum archaeology. Can we dig something up and, by looking at the fossils, figure out something about the past? In quantum mechanics, that's a really difficult question, and that's what I'd like to ask. Are we allowed to ask questions about the past? And I'll give a sense in which I think we are, and that's where weak measurement comes in. So for the last part of the talk, I'll tell you about how weak measurement works, some problems that I think it solves, some other problems that I have to admit it creates, and I'll leave you with the questions that I still don't know the answer to, which would be a long, long list. So just to get started, reality. What is reality? What does an atom look like? How should I describe it? We've all seen pictures like this of different molecules. That happens to be my drug of choice if I went to the right web page. But of course, that's not really a picture of the atoms, right? It's a cartoon of how atoms are arranged. And we just draw little dots and label them with a C or an N or whatever to say it's carbon or nitrogen. But what can we say about what the atom itself looks like? Well, this was more or less the puzzle at the beginning of quantum mechanics, at the turn of the 20th century, to figure out why there were different atoms, what they were made of, and what caused them to behave the way that they did. And one of the first pictures that came out at that point after the electron was discovered, I think 1897 or something, was the plum pudding model, the idea that maybe the atom was just like a little plum pudding, some ball of positive charge that had these little negatively charged raisins or electrons stuck in it. And of course, that was superseded by pictures that might look more familiar to you of the electrons orbiting in planetary fashion around the nucleus. But those of you who remember your high school chemistry probably realize that these are nice cartoons, we find them useful, but the textbooks will tell us that's not really what atoms look like. The textbooks have a lot of pictures that look more like this. These are the electron orbitals that we like to talk about. They're meant to represent smeared out clouds of electron probability or of charge. The thing is, these also are helpful pictures for us to understand some of the math we're doing when we talk about the atoms. No one has ever seen anything that looks like that. This is not what you see when you look at an atom. And if you go all the way back to Bohr and Heisenberg in the beginning of quantum mechanics, that's one of the fundamental things they realized that led them towards this new theory. So here's another picture that some may recognize from textbooks of different Bohr orbits, the idea that there are only certain planetary orbits these electrons are allowed to move in, and that as an electron moves from one orbit to another, its energy changes and it gives off that energy as light. And that's why we see these atomic spectra drawn in the bottom right there, the different colors of light that come off and identify different atoms. we never see the electron, we simply see the light. And by looking at that light, we try to infer something about how fast the electron was spinning around. It's like listening to a radio broadcast and saying, oh, somewhere there must be an antenna with electrons bouncing back and forth in the antenna at this frequency, which is why my radio is receiving it. All right, so we try to infer what's going on. And what Heisenberg argued in 1925 in one of the papers that really laid the foundation for the modern theory of quantum mechanics was, I'll just read his abstract, the present paper seeks to establish a basis for theoretical quantum mechanics founded exclusively upon relationships between quantities which in principle are observable. In other words, he thought that the position of the electron was some strange fictitious thing to talk about because no one could ever measure it. It seemed inconceivable that one ever would measure it. And you could still argue today about how much closer we've come. He argued that if we're trying to describe the photons, the light that we actually observe, then we should just build a theory that predicts those observations. And that was the fundamental philosophical break that led to the Heisenberg-Bohr-Copenhagen school of quantum mechanics. One should describe what we can observe and test. Only if you can test it is it really a scientific theory. And if you can't ever see it, you can't ever test it. So all the theory needs to do is predict the colors. And to even talk about those positions becomes somewhat fictitious. In their view, this position was a mathematical object, something that we used to calculate the properties of the light that came out, but not something that was real. So taking that perspective, Heisenberg tried to figure out exactly what kind of mathematical object would behave the right way to give me the answers that I'm looking for. And what he found was something very strange that even other physicists of the day didn't understand at all. It was based on new mathematics that no one had found an application for previously, known as matrices. Basically, tables of numbers, like this table here. This table is not meant to be a list of a bunch of different positions of different things. Somehow, in Heisenberg's language, that table, that matrix, is the position. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means to say an electron is at and to write down that list of numbers. And neither did Heisenberg. But the thing is, he didn't care. He thought the only purpose of this thing is to plug it into formulas to predict the color of the light that comes out. If that's the thing you have to write down to make the prediction, that's what I'm going to write down. And to tell me that doesn't sound like a position because I can't give it a particular point in space is to ask the wrong question, since we never observe those positions. Well, anyway, these matrices are basically the origin of the uncertainty principle. When Heisenberg concluded that we can't know both the position and the speed or the momentum of a particle at the same time, it was because of the properties of these funny objects. But you already see it in a way. This object is not some number. This doesn't say that I'm at 42 degrees of north latitude. It can't specify some precise position. And that was more or less how we got led there in the first place. The question is position really just that? Or is it rather that we haven't come up with a complete description? We don't really know how to describe the position until some future theory shows up. Heisenberg made it very clear, at least at first, what he thought about it. He wrote, "All of my meager efforts go toward killing off and suitably replacing the concept of the orbital path, which one cannot observe." He thought that it was nonsense to try to talk about the real position of the electron, to draw these orbitals, or when Schrödinger came out with his wave theory, to draw those wave functions that I showed you the chemistry textbook pictures of before. Heisenberg hated that initially. He said, you're drawing pictures of things one cannot observe. That cannot be an important part of the theory. All right? But on the other hand, we still like to draw these pictures and ask whether those tell us something about the position of the electron as well. So which one of those is the right way to look at it, or whether they're both different sides of the same coin, I'm not really going to try to answer for you. I'll just leave you with that sense that as of 1926, Heisenberg was really arguing one should never draw these visualizable, anschaulich pictures, and Schrödinger and his friends were very, very attached to the idea that a picture of nature should be something you can have a picture for in your mind. It should be some cartoon, and you should understand what the cartoon means. And we've been struggling with that for the 90 years ever since, more or less. So let me switch gears a little bit so I can try to connect this to some of the other things that were going around at the time. There had been a debate that many of you, again, have heard something about the nature of light. And questions about the nature of light, I'm sure, go back as far as humans were asking questions, certainly back to the ancient Greeks and earlier. But as far as modern physics goes, the story of light really begins largely with Newton and the people he was arguing against. Newton concluded that light was made up of little particles, even though we never saw those little particles, the same way Democritus had concluded that the air was made up of little atoms, even though we never see those atoms. But Fresnel, Poisson, and Arago concluded that light must be a wave, and this was very contentious since there was good evidence for the particle theory as well, and it wasn't until the late 19th century that we knew what it was a wave of, that we realized that light was simply electricity and magnetism, the same way that radio waves are electricity and magnetism. So it's really quite a recent development, about 150 years ago, that that was finally recognized. And then suddenly, 1900, there was a new problem. And in order to explain some of the effects that led precipitously to the quantum theory, Max Planck had to argue that when light was emitted by some glowing object, it was emitted one particle at a time. Even though he knew perfectly well that it was a wave, the only way he could get the right answer was to say, well, somehow, when it's emitted, it acts like a particle. And 5 years later, in his work on the photoelectric effect, for which he won his Nobel Prize, Einstein argued that actually, when light was absorbed, it also behaved like a particle. So somehow, they've concluded again that Newton was right after all, despite all of this 19th century physics. Light seems to be a particle. Usually this is presented as the paradox that really kicked off quantum mechanics, and I think it's nicely encapsulated in another cartoon I found. Here's this little photon flying along, trying to figure out what his position is or what his momentum is, until he remembers, I'm not even sure if I'm a wave or a particle. Why am I worrying about all of that stuff again? Well, that really is the problem. Einstein's perspective was that somehow light was a wave and a particle at the same time. If you detected it, it would fall one billiard ball at a time into that corner pocket. But if you let it propagate, different waves of light could overlap and form what we call interference patterns, which are the basic defining feature of a wave. Well, how can it be both of these things at the same time? Well, why don't we see it being a particle? That turns out to be a relatively easy question to answer. These particles of light, these photons, are so small that there is something like, I don't even know how to count that anymore, I don't know, a billion of them in a billionth of a second or something like that coming out of a typical light bulb. So we never see particles one at a time. It's like looking at the water in the ocean and trying to see it one molecule at a time. We know it's made up of molecules, but there are too many for us to be sensitive to that. It's a little different because it turns out that in a dark enough room, sufficiently adapted to the dark, your eye might well be sensitive to one photon at a time. It certainly is sensitive to three or four photons at a time, and people are still arguing over that last one or two. But most of the time, we're not really in that dark a room. We don't get to experience this. Well, what is this interference I'm talking about? As I said, it's when two waves overlap. If you imagine a water wave, let's say, going through two holes in some kind of a dam, where they overlap, there are places where they reinforce and places where they cancel out. And that gives rise to regions where the waves get even bigger and other regions where the waves get very small. Or in the case of light, places where the light gets very intense and places where it gets dimmer. And in the real world, you see this all the time. Here's a nice picture of a soap film that gives a similar kind of interference. And all those stripes of different colors are because each color has certain places where it gets brighter and other places where it gets dimmer. And you get this nice rainbow effect along the way. So how is it that if light is made of these photons, we can get this effect? This effect is something that only occurs because the light could have gone through this upper slit or through this lower slit. And if I block one of the slits, I never see this. It's always the sum of two waves that gives me that kind of effect. But if the light is traveling one particle at a time, each particle must go through one slit or the other slit. And you would expect that it would never experience this kind of interference. If you knew which slit it went through, it could not. So this was the subject of big debates that raged between Bohr and Einstein, again, in the early days of quantum mechanics, particularly at a conference in 1927. If I measured which slit one of these particles went through, then it would be just as though I had closed the other slit and there couldn't be any interference. And here's how that was summarized in a somewhat famous cartoon in The New Yorker. Imagine seeing that skier and saying, well, he could only have gotten there by going both ways, but I wasn't looking at him when he went around the tree. I don't know which way he went. That's the position quantum mechanics is in. that if you only look at the final state, you say, yeah, he went both ways. And then you have to rack your brains thinking, well, how is it possible for him to have gone both ways at the same time? To Bohr, this was the most important aspect of quantum mechanics, and it was the principle that he named complementarity. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with this picture. There are many similar examples. This is a picture of two women. How many of you see two women? Oh, it's pretty good. So for those of you who don't, God, I've got a terrible perspective on this now. This is either an eye or an ear. It depends which woman you're looking at, right? It's either a young woman facing away from us or an older woman whose chin is down here, whose eye is there, and whose nose is there. And it gets really difficult to switch back and forth between those two. Some people are better at it than others. But as far as Bohr was concerned, that was what quantum mechanics was like. Particles and waves, it was all different aspects of the same thing, and you could never bring yourself to see them both at the same time. If you looked for interference, you looked for this wave-like effect, you would see the wave-like effect. If you looked to measure, did the skier go to the left around the tree or to the right around the tree, you would see one or the other. But you couldn't ever look for both at the same time. Depending on what you chose to observe, you would see one kind of behavior or another. Okay? So that's the idea of complementarity. But it's a little bit disturbing. So here are some more quotes from Heisenberg and Einstein. Heisenberg said, "We cannot observe electron orbits inside the atom. Now, since a good theory must be based on directly observable magnitudes, I thought it more fitting to restrict myself to these, treating them, as it were, as representatives of the electron orbits." In other words, if you can't observe the positions, you don't talk about the positions. Talk about what you can measure. And Einstein protested, "You don't seriously believe that none but observable magnitudes must go in a physical theory." In other words, you don't really believe that we can't talk about what was behind the observation? Shouldn't we talk about what the electron was doing that caused it to emit the photon, and not just the photon that we saw at the end? Isn't it okay for us to ask what's going on in the center of the sun, even though all we really see is our own suntans and sunburns, and we have to use all sorts of reasoning to figure out where those might come from? Well, unfortunately, Heisenberg and Bohr had good answers to this, because that's kind of exactly how Einstein became famous. His theory of relativity was based on the idea of saying, if you want to talk about space, you want to talk about time, you tell me what you mean by it. You tell me how you're going to measure distances. You tell me how you're going to build clocks. And otherwise, there's nothing to talk about. So Heisenberg responded, saying, "Isn't that precisely what you've done with relativity?" And I was impressed by Einstein's response, "A good joke should not be repeated too often." In other words, it was okay when I did it, but I don't believe it for your theory. Well, anyway, this is the debate that has still remained unresolved. How should you think about reality? Quantum mechanics is very good at predicting what are we going to observe if you tell me what experiment you're going to do. Not so good at talking about what was really happening when I wasn't looking. Okay? Well, I don't want to say that Heisenberg recanted, but he took a slightly different tack later on. And I don't quite know why, but whenever I hunt for pictures of this on the web, the best one I find is in Polish, but Canada is multicultural enough that whenever I show it, there's at least one Polish-speaking person in the audience who seems grateful to have something in their native language. So hopefully there's someone out there today. But I think the picture is pretty self-explanatory. Heisenberg started thinking about what it would mean to measure the position of an electron if you could measure the position of an electron. So we're going to take a microscope and we're going to look at the electron. He knew we couldn't really do that, but it was a thought experiment. What would it require? He figured, well, you'll set up a microscope. Here's microscope, staring at some electron, and you hope that some light will bounce off the electron through the microscope into your eye. But the light's got to come from somewhere, right? So you also have to have a lamp shining photons onto the electron. At least one photon had better bounce off the electron into the microscope and hit your eye. And he said, but wait a second. One of the things that we learned from Einstein is that photons carry momentum. If a photon bounces off something, it's just like a billiard ball bouncing off of something, it gives some momentum to that object. So when the photon bounces off this way, the billiard ball, the electron, goes off at 45 degrees down there, or some other angle, and its momentum has changed. So his argument was, even if you could measure the position of the electron, you would have to disturb its momentum in order to do that. And he argued that this was fundamental. It wasn't just a problem with this particular measuring scheme, but that any way you ever tried to measure the position of anything, it would have to disturb the momentum. And that was his new sort of more intuitive reasoning behind the uncertainty principle. Why can't I say where something is and how fast it's going? Because if I really wanted to know where it was, I would change how fast it's going and by a random amount. And it works the other way around too. If I could really measure how fast it was going, it turns out I would have to change where it was. So position and momentum must be uncertain. You can't measure anything without disturbing it. And there are a number of interesting consequences. One of them is it means you can't really discuss where a particle came from. At some instant, I could imagine knowing its position, or I could imagine knowing its momentum. But since I can't know both, I can't really draw these nice planetary orbits anymore. So we come back to Heisenberg's desire to say those orbits were not real things. Okay? You notice that Heisenberg also has now really followed Einstein's lead in terms of relativity. He says, if you want to ask about position, ask about a device designed to measure position. And fundamentally, this is how we proceed in quantum mechanics now. If you want to define some quantity, we really have been reduced to saying, we know what the quantity means classically. I know how I build things that measure that classically. Let me imagine building that and figure out what it measures according to the quantum theory. And that's what I'm going to call position. Whatever a position measuring device measures, that's what position is. All right? There's no more fundamental definition for us. But at the broadest level, the observation is that observations, in the sense of measurements, alter reality. Now, saying observations alter reality is kind of disturbing and more New Age than I want to get. But if you follow this argument about the Heisenberg microscope and you realize there is no such thing as a passive observation, you're never just looking at something, you're shining light on it and then looking at it. An observation is actually an active process. And that's why I prefer to use the word measurement. And not only does it alter reality, but it led some of these founders to remarkably strong statements. Niels Bohr said, when asked about the quantum world, there is no quantum world. And what he meant by that is the world is the things that occur, but they only occur when we, at the macroscopic level, make observations. Before that, there's no world. There are these funny matrices. They predict the probabilities of different things that might happen up at the classical level. But that's not reality. There's nothing down there. It's just mathematics. And Jordan was even more surprising. He said, observations not only disturb what is to be measured, they produce it. There is no world until we measure something. Now, I don't really like that picture, but I want to set the stage. That's sort of one of the most orthodox views of quantum mechanics. Many people disagree with it, but historically, one should know where it comes from. A very important physicist, John Stuart Bell, the fellow who's responsible for that theorem that I argued earlier was one of the two most important developments of the 20th century, had some interesting things to say about this problem of measurement. Describing this Copenhagen school, Bohr and Heisenberg and their friends, he said, it would seem that the quantum theory is exclusively concerned about results of measurement and has nothing to say about anything else, about reality in its own right. But then what exactly qualifies some physical systems to play the role of measurer? Before we were here, in other words, and the universe was evolving, was there a world at all? Would Bohr have said there was no world because there was no observer, there was no measurement? Did the wave function of the universe just evolve in some strange way until some life evolved? And when that life observed the universe, suddenly there was a quantum jump into one particular state or another? Or is life itself good enough, or does the life have to have a PhD, was Bell's final question. This may be more familiar to some of you in the guise of Schrödinger's cat. That's really the same question that Schrödinger was asking about. Right? He imagined this cat inside a box, and he wondered, is a cat an observer? Can a cat force the quantum state to jump into one possibility or another? So he imagined this not very nice scenario where the cat was locked into a box with some radioactive element that would trigger a Geiger counter, that would trigger a hammer, that would break a vial of poison that could kill the cat. So that after some time, the cat might be alive or the cat might be dead. He said, well, if I just do the quantum mechanics, the cat is in what we call a superposition. It's alive plus dead or alive minus dead. But of course, if anyone observes it, you never see a cat that's half alive, half dead. So it must be either alive or dead. Well, if the cat itself is an observer, then it could probably tell whether it was alive or dead, and it would end up in one state or the other. What's the answer to that? Is a cat an observer? Eugene Wigner took it a little further, and he said, well, even if the cat's not an observer, then as soon as I in my laboratory open the box and observe the cat, then that should collapse the state of the CAD into one of these possibilities, right? That measurement should disturb the system. Unless, of course, I'm locked in my laboratory, and then until someone opens the door of my laboratory and collapses my state, I am in the state of believing the CAD is alive and also in the state of believing that the CAD is dead. No one knows where to draw this boundary. The orthodox view of quantum mechanics assumes that at some point a measurement takes place, but there is no rule that says why it should take place at any particular stage or any other. So this is the big philosophical conundrum of quantum measurement. Does measurement really change the state of the world? And if so, how do you know when the measurement occurs? And in what way will it change the world when it does occur? All right. So we don't know the answer to that question. But as I said, there are now practical questions about measurement because of the advances in technology. Oh, right, and I did just want to assure everyone that even though physicists like telling these stories and are now doing experiments they call Schrödinger cat experiments, we only do them on hypothetical cats. We occasionally do them on real atoms, but the atoms don't seem to complain. Only hypothetical cats, though. So this leads back to Bohr and Einstein, and Einstein was very unhappy with this way of describing the quantum world. So think about it again. If position and velocity and everything else are uncertain, until you measure them, does that mean that the universe is random, some kind of a crapshoot? Now, you've probably all heard this quote that people say Einstein may have never said, which is that he can't believe that God plays dice with the universe. And I read somewhere that when Einstein did or didn't say that, Bohr responded, "Albert, stop telling God what to do. Our job here is to figure out what the rules are, not decide what we think we'd like the rules to be." He really believed that when you make a measurement, one thing or the other happens randomly. Cat may be alive, the cat may be dead. Well, what are the options? There can't be both a position and a velocity in the quantum theory. That was Heisenberg's rigorously proven uncertainty principle. But if I measure position, I get some answer, and if I measure velocity, I get some answer. So how can it be impossible to know both? Well, one way you could think about it is you could imagine that particles really do have definite positions and definite momenta, but that, as in Heisenberg's microscope example, whenever I measure one, I change the other. So I can never be sure what they both were, because by the time I've checked one, I've disturbed the other. But they were both there. And the other viewpoint, and this is the more modern viewpoint, is that particles don't actually have definite positions and momenta. It's not just a limitation on my measurement. It's a statement about reality. Position, momentum, most other things we think of as normally well-defined are actually uncertain at the very deep level of reality. And then maybe the quantum state collapses to have one value or another when we look at it. This argument came to a head in 1935 when Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen imagined a really fascinating thought experiment, Gedanken experiment, now known as the EPR paradox, although there's really no paradox. And the idea was the following. They imagined that there was some source, some object, let's say, that split into two pieces that flew in opposite directions. And one observer, we like to call her Alice, gets one piece, and the other one, we call him Bob, gets the other. And they pointed out that there was a situation where those two things could be correlated in both position and in velocity. In other words, since they fly off with opposite velocities, if Alice measures how fast hers is going, she immediately knows exactly how fast Bob's is going. And on the other hand, if Alice chooses to measure where her particle is, turns out she can also predict exactly where Bob's particle is. So she can't do both of these things, right? She can't measure the velocity and the momentum, because whichever one she chooses to measure, she would disturb the other. But what Einstein reasoned was the following. Alice and Bob might be very, very far apart. So far apart that nothing Alice does can influence anything in Bob's laboratory, because Einstein had famously shown that no physical influences could travel faster than light. So if Bob was off on Alpha Centauri, which is about 4 light-years away, Alice would have 4 years to do her choice of measurements, in which time she could not affect anything that happened in Bob's lab. Okay? The problem is that he said, wait a second, if she chooses, she can predict what a measurement of the position of his particle will be and be 100% guaranteed to be exactly right. But if she chooses, she could predict the value of the momentum instead. But she's not changing the state of his particle. It's too far away. So if she could predict something without changing what's going on, that something must have a definite value. How could I be certain I'm predicting the position unless it has a definite position? How could I be certain I'm predicting the correct momentum unless it has a definite momentum? So that was Einstein's conclusion. It must be that even though quantum theory can't explain it, in quantum theory, at least one of those has to be uncertain, the real world must have definite positions and definite momenta. The alternative, Einstein said, was what he called spukhafte Fernwirkungen. It's better than Farfignugen. It's one of my favorite unpronounceable German phrases. Spooky actions at a distance, or ghost-like actions at a distance. Somehow, when Alice chose to measure position, the other particle would know, oh, I'm supposed to have a definite position. And if instead she chose to measure momentum, the other particle would choose to have a definite momentum. He thought that was ludicrous. And interestingly enough, most people now seem to think that's exactly what happens. It was this argument that caused Schrödinger in 1935 to coin this term entanglement that we use all the time, that somehow the two particles are connected in such a way that I can't even talk about the state of one particle without also talking about the state of the other particle at the same time. Well, what's the alternative? Einstein's alternative was something we now refer to as hidden variables. His argument was, we can write down the quantum state of this thing, and the quantum state does not tell me exactly where or how fast the particles are moving. But that doesn't mean that's the end of the story. It just means that's as far as we've gotten in our theory today. There's some deeper reality, some deeper theory that we don't know about yet. Quantum mechanics is not wrong, but it may be incomplete. And his picture of this, one of his pictures, was explained by John Bell about 30 years later, in the example of Bertelmann's socks. And he talked about this Professor Bertelmann, who had the odd idiosyncrasy that he always liked to wear two socks of different colors. And he said, look, the instant he starts walking through a doorway and you see that his left sock is pink, you know that his right sock is not pink. But do you really believe for a moment that it was your observation of the color of that sock that changed the color of the other sock? Obviously not. You just believe that there already was some color to the other sock that you discovered belatedly. For years, I just thought this was a cute example dreamed up by John Bell, and then one day I happened upon the following photograph and discovered that that is none other but Professor Bertelmann, who was sharing an office with Bell at the time at CERN in Geneva, and just to poke fun at him, Bell decided to use him as this example. He now travels around having his photos taken at quantum information conferences. Anyway, Bell did something really remarkable. Bell said, let's think about the consequences. What if Einstein was right? What if there really were some model, some theory out there that I don't know yet, but that told me the color of each of his socks? And what he did is he showed for any such theory, even though I don't know what it is, there's a certain mathematical expression, the inequality that I've written here, that has to be satisfied. And the details of that inequality don't matter to us right now. But what they're doing is comparing four different probabilities. It's basically instructions. It says, measure the probability of this happening, this happening, this happening, this happening. And if you add up the three on the right, they've got to be bigger than the thing on the left. For any theory that behaves the way Einstein wanted, any theory where things have definite values before you measure them. This is Bell's inequality. And countless experiments have been done, like this one here, where as I move along this axis, I'm changing one parameter, and as I move between these two curves, I'm changing another parameter, and it doesn't even matter. I don't need to tell you what these parameters are. As long as I show you data like this and say, here are four circled points that correspond to the probabilities in here, these three points are the ones on the right-hand side. They're all just a little below 100 on this scale. And this one is the one on the left-hand side. It's just a little over 400 on this scale. Well, the three things on the right add up to something smaller than the thing on the left. And that means immediately that there is no local hidden variable theory, no theory of realistic predetermined reality that could possibly reproduce this result. So this is not a proof of quantum mechanics. We can never prove quantum mechanics. It might always be overturned in some other regime later on. To me, the remarkable thing is that even though I fully believe that one day we'll have something that goes beyond quantum mechanics and I have no idea what it looks like, this is a mathematical theorem. We know that that new theory will share the strangest feature of quantum mechanics. It will have to share this feature of non-locality. So that's the sense in which it now seems that there really is spooky action at a distance. We cannot build a theory like the one Einstein wanted. We have to recognize that somehow when I make a measurement here, it actually changes the state of affairs somewhere else. The particles don't know what they're doing until they're measured. So given that, we finally get to my recent obsession, which is this quantum archaeology business. If I open the door and make a measurement, I can see what's there now. But if I can't have particle trajectories, I can't talk about where things were going, every observation changes the system, is it impossible for me to figure out what happened in the past? Can we talk about what the age of the Earth is, or is it silly for us to even ask what was going on before we existed? Well, obviously most of us think it's reasonable. There are a few skeptics out there. But I'd like to try to convince you that there's a very clear sense in which it makes sense. I grew up in New York, and as kids, we used to spend our spare time trying to cheat tourists out of their money by putting money under one of three shells and mixing them up and asking them to guess which one had the money, right? I think you all know how this game works. I want to show you the physicist version of this game. This is Schrodinger's money. So I'm not going to be so simple as to just, you know, put the money under shell A and scramble them up and see whether your eye is fast enough to figure out where shell A is. And I'm not actually going to cheat. I'm not going to remove the bill when you're not looking or anything like that. But I'm going to make this just like Schrodinger's cat. Instead of putting it in A or B, I'm going to put it in this superposition, A plus B, or for the experts, A plus B over the square root of 2. But now I'm going to tell you something else. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to look for the money at the end of the day. And I'm going to look for it in a particular other superposition. And if I don't find it, all bets are off and we start over. So I promise that eventually I'm going to prepare it like this in A plus B, but I'm going to find it in B plus C. And your job is to tell me where the bill was after I put it in A plus B and before I found it in B plus C. So this is audience participation time. Who can tell me where the bill must have been between the preparation and that finding? B, I knew that was going to happen and I love it. You know why I love it? Because I use the same example with physics audiences, and they're always completely silent. No physicist is ready to tell me the answer to that question. Once one did, but out of the entire audience, one person sort of whispered B. And that's because you're thinking about this intuitively, and I would say you're thinking about this correctly. You know that if I put it in A plus B, it's got to be in either A or B, and if I put it in B plus C, it's got to be in either B or C, and the only way it can be both of those is if it's in B. And what I want to tell you is that I agree with you, but that there's a reason that most physicists will not answer the question. They're not really comfortable with telling you whether A plus B and A or B is the same thing or not. And I find that remarkable. Almost 100 years after the beginning of quantum mechanics, we know how to solve all these equations. We can calculate whatever we like. But if you ask me what it means, I have to hesitate. I'm not sure it's that simple. Let me do another calculation. Tell me exactly what you want to measure. And that would have been Bohr's answer. Bohr actually would have said it was a stupid question. He would have said, you didn't describe an experimental apparatus that was set up to measure whether or not it was in B. You're not allowed to ask the question. Like Heisenberg, only talk about the observables. And now we want to try to move beyond that a little bit. So, yes, I want to say that it had to be in B with 100% certainty, but we've got to figure out what are we calculating? What is the measurement device that we have in mind? Okay? Well, how do we think about measurements at all? This is a trick, but basically, I think about measurements as being something like this. I mean, all right, maybe it's digital nowadays, but it comes down to the same thing. There's some device. You hook the device up to the thing you want to measure, and the needle on the device moves, okay, or the display changes, or whatever. And eventually, it comes down to my eye picking up some photons from my computer screen or from the light shining on that dial or what have you. But we have to model not how my brain interacts with the electron. Probably, we don't need to wait that long to see what happened to the electron. But if we understand how the voltmeter interacted with the electron, we'll probably get a good portion of the distance there. So this was something that in probably about 1940, John von Neumann already did when trying to formalize the basics of quantum mechanics. And he realized that if this pointer, this needle on my ammeter or what have you, was described by the laws of physics, and the laws of physics are quantum mechanical, then it doesn't really look like this cartoon anymore because it has an uncertain position. Just like the electron, that pointer must be described by a wave function, some probability distribution of different positions. So here's the picture he came up with. He said, when you try to measure something, you start with a pointer, and you try to reset it to zero, but there's some uncertainty, there's some width to this probability distribution over here. And then you let your pointer interact with the system that you want to measure. And if you've engineered the thing right, after it interacts, the pointer will shift to one position or another or another. And you can tell which one it shifted to because the uncertainty is small enough. In modern language, what really happens is the pointer becomes entangled with the system. If the system is off on the left, the pointer ends up off on the left. If the system is off to the right, the pointer ends up off to the right. And they're just like these Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen particles. You can't talk about what the system is doing without understanding what the pointer is doing. And that, in fact, can be seen as the origin of collapse, or what we like to call decoherence in modern terminology of quantum mechanics. It's what leads to this large disturbance on the system. It really all comes down to the pointer. Another way to see that is this pointer may have a very definite position, but if it has a very definite position, it must have a very indefinite momentum because of the uncertainty principle. It turns out, if its momentum is very uncertain, when it interacts with the system, it kicks the system all over the place. It's guaranteed to disturb the system because of that uncertainty in momentum. So we need to get around this. And here's the proposal due to Yakir Aharonov and some of his collaborators, David Albert Lev Weidman, starting back around 1988, that's taken a good 20 years to kind of gain, I don't even want to say widespread acceptance, gain the interest of the widespread community in arguing against, at the very least. Someone's taking it seriously enough that they want to argue about it. And many of us take it seriously now, but it's remained controversial. And the idea was the following. It just had to do with that three-shell game again. The question is, if I prepare something in some initial state, but I guarantee that later I find it in a particular final state, how can I talk about something that I imagine measuring in between? Does it depend on how I prepared it or on the final state? The way we're taught to do quantum mechanics, we're taught you prepare things, there are rules to predict the future. When a measurement happens, we all get a little confused, we erase the last sheets of paper, we start over, and then we predict the future again. So there's no way to go backwards in time, there are no trajectories. Every time you do a measurement, you reset the clock. So, of course, what I want to say is that it depends on both the initial state and the final state. And we do have the right to conclude that my $20 bill was in shell B. The problem is Bohr's viewpoint on measurement, Heisenberg's picture of measurement, that says that it leads to an uncontrollable, irreversible disturbance. And that's what I tried to show you in von Neumann's cartoon a moment ago. But here was Aharonov's answer. What if when we measure this variable A, whatever the position, the momentum, which box the money is under, whatever we care about, we measure it weakly? In other words, we don't let the interaction between the pointer and the system be too strong. Then we figure the pointer can't disturb the system that much. If we didn't couple them that strongly, what's going to go wrong? Now, the flip side is we don't get a lot of information. We're not going to get very good information anytime we measure one particle. But if we average over many, many trials of the same thing, he figured we'd still get some answer about, on average, how big A was. Let's try to do that. So here's how he modified the von Neumann picture. Instead of starting with that extremely well-localized wave function, that very narrow probability distribution for the pointer, let's let the pointer be really, really uncertain. This is what von Neumann thought was stupid. He said, look, there's some uncertainty, but let's let it be really small, otherwise how could you measure anything? And Aharonov said, that's okay, let it be very uncertain. And he found that what happens is that after the interaction with the system, that whole uncertain distribution moves by a little bit and essentially doesn't disturb the system at all. Now, if I look at just one example of this happening, I look at one pointer, what's going to happen? Well, this is a probability distribution. If I look at the pointer, I'll either find it here or here or here or there. I won't really know that the distribution shifted. But that's not how any experiment is done. Experiments are done by repeating things thousands, millions, even billions of times and taking an average. After I've done this experiment enough to make a plot like that blue curve on the right, now I can figure out how much the center shifted by and really extract the value. So that was his answer to how to do these conditional measurements. If I don't disturb the particle very much in the middle, then I can still post-select. I can ask, did it get to final state F or not? And then, if I repeat this many times, I can talk about what happened between the preparation and that post-selection. So here's a cartoon of exactly what we mean. Imagine a pointer that that has a huge uncertainty. I don't know where it's pointing. One of these red arrows is the initial state of the pointer. And here's a system, some funny wave function, an electron, I don't really care what it is. And these two are going to interact over here. And after they interact, I'll be able to read off where the pointer is, but I'll just find the pointer in some more or less randomly chosen direction. But now we're going to add this post-selection. We're going to look at the system and do some sort of a measurement where there's some final state we like to see, like that B plus C I talked about, and some other states we don't want. And we're going to say, let's only keep these green states. And we're going to do this many, many times and build up statistics. So every time we let a system interact with a pointer, we'll check, did we get to the desired final state or the wrong one? If we got to the wrong one, we throw out the pointer. I just don't care about it. But only when we get to that state that I promised do we look at the pointer. And each one will be a little bit different because there's randomness in quantum mechanics. But after I do this thousands of times, I get a range of different pointer positions. And as I plot that range, I can see that the distribution shifted. And what Aharonov said is that shift is something I'll call the weak value. It's the best we can do if we want to describe what's the average value of this thing we were observing just in those cases where we got to the right final state. And he was able to calculate this, and he showed no matter how you do this measurement, I've been very general about what I'm measuring and what the pointer's made of, turns out it doesn't matter. There's a simple enough formula, I don't know, for physicists that's a simple enough formula, but it's not that different from things that we already work with, that tells us how to compute this. And it tells us how to compute something that's directly related to a measurement you could imagine doing. Right? So that's the important thing. It's not just something that some theorist cooked up and said, I feel like defining it this way. He said, I'm going to define it by saying this is the only thing you could do in the lab, and I can predict what you'll get if you do it in the lab. Very down-to-earth kind of definition. Turns out it has a lot of strange properties, though. And because of that funny way of measuring it, where no individual measurement really gives you a lot of information, some people argue that you should not think of this as a measurement. And that debate is not yet concluded. We're still trying to figure out what this means. They would basically, well, I think you can already see that I'm not on this side of the argument. As far as I'm concerned, what they're saying is a measurement was defined on page 36 of my textbook, and that's not what it says, so this is not a measurement. And I don't think that's the right way to look at it. I think the right way to look at it is to say that quantum mechanics aims to give a mathematical description of what you might do in the real world to measure things. You figure out how you actually get information in the real world, and then you write down the math that describes it. And if you can't get information by measuring too strongly, because that's going to disturb the system, it's natural to say, let me measure a little more gently. This tells you what will happen if you do that. So to me, it's the natural operational way to extend the idea of measurement once you have something like post-selection. So I want to tell you about at least one or two cases where I think this is useful to show you why I think it's interesting that we can do these weak measurements now, and also to admit to you what some of the weaknesses of weak measurements are. The main one I want to tell you about, and given the time, it may become the only one I want to tell you about, is something known as quantum seeing in the dark, which is yet another way of measuring something without measuring it in the textbook fashion. This is often referred to as interaction-free measurement, although, as far as I'm concerned, it'll always be Weidmann's bomb experiment. It was written by Avshalom Elitzur and Lev Weidmann back in 1993, and Weidmann is a kind of bombastic guy, bombastic militaristic Israeli. I don't think he'll take exception with me for describing him that way. And unfortunately, to my mind, his beautiful description of this paradox that had to do with bombs got pacified because some of his followers ended up working on these experiments at Los Alamos National Laboratories where they were just on the verge of trying to claim they were a peaceful institution and didn't really like bombs that much anymore. So I think they were all told they weren't allowed to use that word. Nevertheless, I'm going to go back to the original version of the story and try to explain to you what's so shocking about it. It begins with a little parable. And we're going to consider a collection of really good bombs. So that's a matter of definition, but for the sake of argument, I'm the good guy, and me having bombs that works is going to be considered a good thing for the purposes of this discussion. And these bombs are extremely sensitive. They're infinitely sensitive in some sense. In other words, they all have little triggers on them that could be set off by the slightest sound, the slightest gust of air, or even a single air molecule or photon or electron, one anything, is guaranteed to make these bombs blow up. Okay? So obviously, I have to store them pretty carefully. And they're all shipped with these hermetically sealed chambers over the triggers so that nothing interacts with them and they don't blow up. And to arm the bomb, you have that chamber removed. But one day I get a phone call from the manufacturer of the bombs. He's very apologetic, and he says, "We just realized in the last batch of bombs we shipped, half of the bombs are defective." And I said, "What do you mean defective?" And he says, "Well, they're never going to blow up. The other bombs will blow up, and these will not. It's entirely our own fault. I'm really sorry about it. And if you return them, we'll replace them free of charge." And I say, "Okay, which half?" And he says, "Well, you know, they're bombs. You just blow them up anyway. We don't take the time to scratch serial numbers on them or anything. Just send back the ones that don't work." Yeah, right. I don't want to already be trying to use it and discover that it doesn't work. And on the other hand, I don't want to blow up all the good bombs before I need to. So I ask him, "Well, you've got to tell me some other way of identifying them. Like which one is heavier or lighter, or which one smells different?" And he says, "No, it's actually quite interesting. There is no physical difference between the working bomb and the malfunctioning bomb, except that the working bomb will blow up and the malfunctioning bomb will not." Right? So you all see the problem. If there's no other physical difference, there is no conceivable way that I could tell that some bomb was working without blowing it up, right? And that's what 20 years ago Herzog and Weidmann showed was not true according to quantum mechanics. According to classical intuition, classical physics, it's obvious and it's true. Quantum mechanically, it's wrong. So here's the way you do it. It comes back to interference. So those of you who are a little bit familiar with Bohr-Einstein debates or interference will recognize some of this. The others will just trust me. This is something called an interferometer, a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, where you imagine having a photon that reaches what we call a beam splitter, something that either lets the photon be transmitted or reflected with 50-50 probabilities. So the photon either takes this left arm or this right arm. That's like the two paths, that double slit interferometer I talked about before. But then it comes back, and the two beams meet up at a second beam splitter that could send either beam to either detector C or detector D with no way to tell them apart. So it turns out here's an example where you get interference. Each photon, in some sense, travels through both paths and knows that it should get to detector C, where there's constructive interference, the way I've drawn this. And at detector D, there's what we call destructive interference. Not a single photon reaches it. It's what we call a dark port. All the photons know to go to C. Okay, that's basically a standard interferometer. But remember, you can't see the particle nature and the wave nature at the same time. If you measure which path the particle takes, Bohr tells us it's going to stop exhibiting wave-like behavior. You're going to destroy the interference. And sure enough, that's what happens. So if I place a bomb with its trigger in one of these paths over here, that's a pretty good way of getting information about which path the photon took. At least if the trigger is working, then if I'm blown to smithereens, I figure the photon took the right-hand path. And if I'm still standing here talking to you, I figure, I guess, the photon didn't take that path. Okay, if it's a working bomb, we're assuming for now that we have a working bomb. If, on the other hand, it's not a working bomb, then nothing happens at all. All right, well, the thing with information is if I don't blow up, so I know the photon went this way, then when the photon comes here, there's nothing left for it to interfere with. There is no photon coming from the other side anymore. There is no interference. So the photon that comes here has, again, a 50-50 chance of going to C or to D. So if you work it all out, half the time I'm blown to kingdom come, one quarter of the time detector C fires and I'm still standing here wondering what happened, and one quarter of the time detector D fires. Now, the thing is, detector D never fired when the bomb wasn't there, and it would never fire if I had a missing detector, a broken detector that couldn't get any information. So every time detector D fires, I say, that's interesting, something broke the interferometer. There must be a working bomb there. And hey, I'm still here. So the photon must not have interacted with the working bomb. I've learned that the bomb would have exploded if the photon went there. And yet I know the photon didn't go there. So completely impossible classically. And it turns out it's really quite simple quantum mechanically. So as I said, a lot of people think that quantum mechanics teaches us that all of these old sayings are right about the moon not being there when nobody looks and trees not making a noise if you're listening to your iPod too loudly and things like that. I would say that's all backwards. What we learn from this picture is that, in fact, quantum mechanics can tell me what sound the tree would have made while it's falling, even if the tree doesn't fall. It's exactly the opposite of the way people think about the observer's role in quantum mechanics. So this may seem awfully strange, since I've been arguing that when you measure something, you must disturb it. And here I presented a way of sort of measuring something, gaining information about whether or not the bomb's there, without disturbing it. People knew that wasn't supposed to be possible. And one of them, Lucien Hardy, who's now at the Perimeter Institute, came up with a really interesting paradox while thinking about what goes on in this situation. And here's how it's constructed. He said, look, suppose I didn't know whether the bomb was in the way or not. It was in one of these Schrodinger cat states, a superposition of being in the way and not being in the way. When I measure it, the whole picture of quantum mechanics is I change the state. It has to choose to be in or out. It has to be collapsed or decohered. So let's imagine doing that. Let's try to come up with a quantum bomb that can be both in the way and not in the way at the same time. His way of doing that was to imagine two particles that would annihilate when they met. Well, a positron or an anti-electron, when it meets up with an electron in the right way, disappears in a burst of gamma radiation. So he imagined not making an interferometer for photons, like the one that I drew, but the same exact idea, only for positrons. And he said, now, every positron will hit the constructive port and never get to the dark port, D plus over here. If I put an electron in the way, so that the positron going through this W region would go off in a burst of smoke, then I'll start seeing positrons at D plus. So let's imagine sending an electron that's either in the way or not in the way, and ask, when D plus fires and I conclude that the electron is here, how did I disturb the state of the electron? That's what we'd like to understand. Well, one way you could check that is to bring the two halves together and try to make the electron into an interferometer. Now, when you look at this, I think the symmetry leaps out at you immediately, right? I can think of this as a positron interferometer that's checking whether or not there's an electron here, but I can also think of this as an electron interferometer that's checking whether or not there's a positron here, because the electron will blow up if it meets the positron, but the positron will blow up if it meets the electron, right? So if detector D plus fires, we conclude the electron was in. If detector D minus fires, we conclude the positron was in. If they both fire, we conclude they were both in. But remember how the story started. If they were both in, they were guaranteed to blow up. Well, if they turned into gamma radiation, then I couldn't possibly detect them later on. So obviously, there's no way you could ever have D plus and D minus fire at the same time. All right? If you just believe basic classical logic and you believe how this Elitzur-Weidman bomb detector actually works, that's kind of ironclad reasoning. Unfortunately, if you actually just do the calculation, which isn't really that hard, less than one page, it turns out that's not true. One time out of 16, D plus and D minus do fire. And this was the paradox. It seemed to say that maybe Bohr and Heisenberg and those guys were right after all, and it really wasn't fair to claim that I had determined that the electron was in there without really interacting with the electron. There was something misleading about trying to reason about the past, trying to do what we call retrodiction. And this is something that many people argued about. Many people took the point of view that retrodiction, this using present measurements to draw inferences about the past, really is illegal in quantum mechanics. But what I've been trying to convince you, based on Aharonov's ideas, is that there's a very clear way you can do retrodiction, as long as you imagine making your measurements weak so you don't disturb things too much. So it becomes a natural question to ask, what will happen if you do weak measurements? Let's try to go through the reasoning. Let's just draw a little table of probabilities. There are four possibilities, right? The electron was either in the W region or not. The positron was either in the W region or not. So here are four different possibilities. I can write down probabilities for those. And what's the information I'm given at the outset? Well, if D plus and D minus fired, D plus firing convinced me that the electron must be in the W region. So these two numbers add up to 100%. And if D minus fired, I conclude that the positron must have also been in the W region, so these two numbers must add up to 100%. Now, a classical probabilist would think he was done now, but we've got a little more information, which is that the electron and the positron could not have both been in W at the same time, or they would have blown up. So that number is zero. They could not possibly have been there. And if you really wanted to be naive about it, you would just go through and say, well, how do I fill in the magic square? I've got to have ones over there to get the ones on the outside. And now I need a minus one over here so that these two things add up to zero. That's just what you get by following the basic laws of probability and ignoring that one pesky little law that says probabilities are greater than zero. But you know, we'll just ignore that. The funny thing is if you sit down and you construct an example where you try to weakly measure these observables, you try to construct a device that would really be sensitive to the probability of them both being in or both being out or one being out and the other being in, Aharonov and his friends showed that this is exactly what you expect. These numbers that you get from classical reasoning are exactly what you expect in a real measurement. And to me, that's one of the fascinating things about weak measurement. First of all, it lets you ask these questions that seemed impossible. Secondly, it reconciles the things that seem to be paradoxical in Hardy's paradox. It lets you have a one here and a one here, and yet have a zero over there. And of course, we knew there was a problem, so it had to, you know, sweep the dirt somewhere, and the rug it got swept under was the fact that this other thing becomes negative. But it turns out that if you look at that pointer that's supposed to tell you what's the probability, it's a real physical prediction that the pointer will point towards a negative number when you're done. Okay? So what exactly that means, we don't know yet, but that's the operational prediction. And we did the experiment a few years ago. My student Jeff Lundin did this as the culminating part of his PhD thesis. And that's a picture of most of the apparatus. And here are the tables we got. Most of you hopefully are aware that experiment isn't perfect. So 0.24, that's close to zero. 0.72, it's close to one. 0.66 is also close to one. Well, you know, most importantly, I think these 0.92s and 0.88s are really close to one. I'm not as sure about the others. And this minus 0.75 really is negative. I mean, to my mind, we confirmed the important part of the predictions here. You really do get these negative results. Now, calling them probabilities is a little bit provocative. I sometimes do that on purpose, but I should always apologize for it. They're not probabilities in the sense of how often something happens. We never found an electron somewhere minus 10% of the time, right? That's not going to happen. But when we talk about measurements in this quantum sense, where does the pointer go? The pointer goes in the wrong direction. It really does when you do this post-selection. So weak measurements come at a price. They let us ask new questions, and they seem to guarantee that the answers agree with some of the basic axioms and our intuitions, like that the money had to be in box B. If you do a weak measurement of that, it confirms what you all realized right away. The money is definitely in box B. Until you have weak measurements, you don't even know how to ask the question. On the other hand, it does some very, very strange things. So what I have to admit right now is that when you ask me, what do they tell you about what the system is really doing, I hope there's an answer to that. I want to understand more about the reality behind it. But we don't know yet. What we know is that they're defined to tell us how much a system would affect a measuring device on average. And in the end, those are the only things we ever use quantum mechanics to predict. What is the effect on some measuring device? So that's a safe starting point. That's as far as we've gotten there so far. So one last experiment that I'd like to tell you about has to do with going all the way back to Heisenberg and trying to see, can you actually measure that disturbance? Can you see how much measuring a system has to disturb it? And some of you may have seen this article I referred to earlier. It was covered in the BBC about 2 years ago. They said that we had bent a famous quantum mechanics rule by measuring the trajectories of particles in an experiment. And I felt bad about that because we didn't measure the trajectories of individual particles. We all knew that was impossible. We measured something slightly different. I think it was surprising enough, but we certainly didn't bend any rules of quantum mechanics. More importantly than that, I had a very creative PhD supervisor, Ray Chow, and if there's only one thing I learned from his example, it's that you should never bend a rule when you can figure out how to break it completely. So I want to tell you about a different experiment. I want to tell you about one of our latest experiments, which is on actually breaking Heisenberg's rule for how much you have to disturb a particle. So remember, you know, here's this picture. I try to measure which slit a particle goes through, and I must disturb it, because any precise measurement of position, x, is guaranteed to disturb the momentum, we call it P for some reason I can never quite fathom, by an amount given by this formula down here. All right, so I've been teaching quantum mechanics for years, and when I do it, I always make the point that I sort of tried to suggest to you earlier with that discussion of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. This uncertainty principle is not just about measurement. It's about what's really out there. So I always make it clear that although that statement is true, it puts a limit on measurement. It tells us, that's interesting, you can never build a measuring device good enough to measure both the position and the momentum. But the real state of affairs is much deeper than that. It says, forget about what you could measure. Let's talk about what's really out there. Any state of the universe in which the position has a value does not have a definite value for the momentum. They're just not there to begin with. It's not just the fault of your measuring device. Okay? And that's more or less the orthodox way, I think, to teach these things. But what I realized only about 2 years ago is that the first version is less interesting than the second version. It's also wrong. We've just been saying it's less interesting when we could have been saying it's not even true. Heisenberg sort of went back and forth between the two different pictures, and he was just vague enough that you can't actually find a place where he got it wrong. But you can find places where all the rest of us, thinking we were quoting him, got it wrong. So here's a hand-waving example. Suppose that I have some particle that's in some wave function. In other words, that's a probability distribution, different positions it might be in. And it's localized between those two little dots. I know it's certainly no further away than those two dots. Okay, so it has some uncertainty in position, but it's not that big. And okay, it must have a big uncertainty in momentum. Now let me try to measure where it is. Well, how do we really measure where things are? We don't usually actually get a number out that's position. What we do more often is we put a detector somewhere and the detector either fires or not. So what we try to do is we take a particle and we put a slit in front of it and we see if the particle is still there after the slit. And if it is, we say it must have gotten through the slit. I know roughly where it is. So let me do that. I'll send it towards a slit, in other words, a gap between two blocks over here. But if I make the gap between those two blocks, I make that slit wider than the wave function of the particle anyway, well, the particle's guaranteed to get through. In fact, there's no way the particle could even know that the blocks were there. How could I possibly disturb the particle? Well, by the modern viewpoint, in fact, I don't disturb the particle at all. I have made a measurement of position with some uncertainty, it's the width of that slit, and I've confirmed when the particle gets through that it's near x equals zero, and I've confirmed that with some finite precision. But there's been no disturbance on the momentum whatsoever. Now, the real Heisenberg uncertainty principle just tells me that the final uncertainty in momentum of the particle must be bigger than Planck's constant divided by the uncertainty in its position. And it is. But it's not big because I disturbed it. It's big because it already had a big uncertainty. And that's sort of the loophole. What we really know rigorously is that when you know the position to some accuracy, the momentum must be uncertain. The question is, how much of that uncertainty did I create by measuring it? And how much was already there beforehand? And there's a trade-off there. You don't necessarily need to add uncertainty if you begin with something that has enough uncertainty to begin with. Well, this is something that I didn't know until a few years ago. This is Heisenberg's rule for the uncertainties. But the same rule for precision and disturbance of measurements turns out to be wrong. And Ozawa, about 10 years ago, demonstrated that if you really wanted to describe the disturbance due to a measurement, there was a more complicated formula that comes in. The important thing is it looks sort of like the Heisenberg formula would have. It's got the same thing over here on the left. But there are two additional numbers here, two additional positive numbers that make it easier to satisfy Ozawa's inequality than Heisenberg's. In other words, there are situations where you could satisfy this one that's been proved and violate what Heisenberg had that we're just sort of misinterpreting. So this was something you could imagine doing if you could measure the disturbance due to another measurement. And that's the tricky part. How do you measure the disturbance to B? You'd need to know what B is beforehand and then measure it again after. But if you measure what B is beforehand, you've already disturbed it. So you have to do something else after that. And you get this infinite loop of, well, how do I ever know how much I changed it if every time I measure it, I'm also changing it? Unless you have weak measurement. Once you have weak measurement, you can imagine weakly looking at B and then telling whether or not it changed later on. So that was a proposal due to London Wiseman that we ended up implementing. There was another proposal due to Ozawa himself that's a little indirect that was implemented by Erhardt et al. And Hasegawa's group in Vienna around the same time. And I'm not going to actually try to explain how we did this. The basic idea is weak measurement. I'll show you some pictures so you get a flavor of what it looks like. But that's it. There are two things, a system and a pointer interacting. And what we're going to do is do a weak measurement of things beforehand and compare them to the value of the pointer or to a strong measurement afterwards. And if you really try to put this into quantum information circuit diagrams, the way we really implement these things these days, there's the rough circuit diagram for what we tried to do. Turns out it wasn't too easy to do that way, so we had to rewrite it like this. Just turns out it's a little easier to do that one. If you then convert this to what it really looks like in terms of beam splitters and other optical devices, it looks a little more complicated. And then if you actually build the thing, that's what it looks like. That's Dylan Mahler and Lee Rosema, who actually carried out the experiment in my lab at U of T. And it works. That's the bottom line. It works. You measure the disturbance, you measure the precision. That's those two curves. And when you multiply them, ta-da, you find that if you just multiply them directly and take Heisenberg's quantity, it ends up down here in this forbidden region below what he said was the limit on how well you could measure things. And if you take Ozawa's new theory, you realize, no, that's okay. The only thing that's bounded is this other quantity up here. So we directly violated the Heisenberg relation when interpreted as a relationship between measurement precision and the disturbance due to the measurement. But we satisfied the relationship that's supposed to succeed that. So I think I've basically told you most of what I want to say, but I'll just point out that this business about uncertainty and what Heisenberg really meant has really come to the fore over the last few years. And it turns out there are a lot of different related questions that I always thought were exactly the same question. That's why we all trusted Heisenberg's formula. It turns out they're all slightly different. You can ask, how certain can two different variables be in a given state? You can ask, how well can I measure the two of them? And that's not the same question. Or you can ask, how well can I measure one of them, and how much does that disturb the other? All of these turn out to be different questions. And now that we're trying to build quantum computers and quantum communication systems, we actually care about the difference between these questions. So people are still discovering new things about the uncertainty principle from 1926, which to me is one of the most remarkable things in physics, that you can look at these old questions. You know, it's great that we have the LHC, and it's great that we have people looking for black holes, but you can still do experiments on photons and atoms and find surprises. And to me, that's just wonderful. So I will say that weak measurements may still prove to be good for something practical as opposed to just studying quantum foundations and quantum paradoxes. The jury is still out on it, but here's an abstract of one paper that at least suggested that because these weak values, these pointer shifts, can get really, really big if you do the right kind of measurement, you can use that to kind of amplify certain very weak effects. And an example that our colleagues at Rochester, led by John Howell, carried out a few years ago, was to measure tiny, tiny deflections of a laser beam by using this weak measurement, basically amplifying them up. And I'm still always amazed when I read this abstract. They said they were able to measure the deflection of a mirror with a resolution down to 200 femtoradians. That's a fifth of a trillionth of a radian, which is about 60 degrees. It took me a long time to figure out what that even meant. Eventually, I figured it out. If you took a laser beam and shone it towards the moon, and then you moved it by this 200 femtoradians, they quote, the spot, by the time it reached the moon, a quarter of a million miles away, would move by the thickness of one human hair. The precision of that measurement is thanks to ideas that come from weak measurement. Let me just leave you with the morals of the story. There are many different ways you can get information about things, and when we say measurement, that's all we should mean, finding some way to get information about a system. And these different ways are good for different things. Books that say this is what a quantum measurement is because von Neumann said so in 1940 are now out of date. We're looking at new strategies. And when you look at states where you define something by its past and its future, all sorts of strange things we don't really know how to think about yet occur, these things we call post-selected systems. But weak measurements are a very powerful way of thinking about them, although they lead to some things we still don't understand, like these negative probability-like things. And finally, although Heisenberg's relation is true in the context for which it was rigorously proved about the uncertainties of two different variables, it is not true in the way that it's commonly interpreted, limiting the disturbance that I have to make in order to carry out a measurement of a given precision. Okay, so I will leave you with that and with the names of the people who carried out all this work before I forget, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ephraim. Very interesting talk. I noticed Sun Life's attention in particular when the money was moving around through all the shelves. So we'll have a private session afterwards to talk a little bit about the quantum physics there. Given all the arguments, all the mystery for over 100 years, as far as we've come and as far as your work is taking us, do you ever think we'll ever have a really clear grasp on what is going on and why in the strange world of quantum mechanics?
Well, the why is either the hardest or the easiest question. I think I'll say it's the easiest question because the answer is no. Physics never teaches us why. Physics gives us stories that we can tell, and some stories make us more comfortable than others. And we find the simple story, we think, oh, that must be why. But we never really know why. Why is there gravity? Newton never answered that. He just said, if you assume this picture, you get these answers. As for the how, I think we're coming closer and closer. But the gap is still so large that it's way outside of my horizon to imagine quantum mechanics making complete sense to anyone. I would love to see it one day, but I fear that I shan't.
Okay, thank you for that. Question down here.
Well, thank you for that great talk. If we accept that nothing is ever at rest, that means everything's moving, and we try to measure things, if you do, let's say, 1,000 measurements, they're all going to be different because position changes every split second, okay?
That's right.
When you convert that to a mathematical formula, if you will, and then you get a value, that value is a mean or maybe not even a mean.
Okay.
Because we don't know what the distribution, whereabouts in the distribution curve that mathematical value is. Am I getting something wrong or missing something?
No, I mean, anytime we do an actual measurement, we have some finite amount of data that we take, and we never know the whole story. That's true. So in these theoretical pictures, we always have the idealization that you imagine if you could take an infinite amount of data and really graph out the whole distribution, and you'd know exactly where the mean was. But even then, all you would know is the mean. That's quite true.
Okay, and time for one more question down here.
Given the fact that human language evolved to deal with macroscopic objects, is it any surprise that it cannot deal with these? And so long as the math works, why do we care that our words don't match the what we're observing?
That's a beautiful question. And on the second side, I'd say that it comes back to that argument between Einstein and Heisenberg. Is it enough that you predict the outcomes of measurements, or do you also want to have a picture of the reality that was behind it? And a large part of the drive for people who do physics has always been this why that I told John we can't fully answer, understanding what's really going on. And I think it's important to strive for that, because having that intuition is what leads us to new discoveries, either new theories or new applications of the theories. If you can only predict things after you know what to predict, how are you going to decide what to try next, what experiment you should even be doing? So I do think it's very important to have these pictures that go behind, even though there will always be uncertainty. And the bit about language, I think it's certainly true that language and our intuitions about physics have evolved to deal with certain things. And that's why they have to evolve culturally to bring in new ideas. I think today's generation is much more comfortable with the ideas of uncertainty and quantum mechanics than people were in 1900, because the culture has changed. And it's not merely something hardwired in our brains. If anything, I would argue that what's hardwired in our brains comes closer to a mathematical appreciation of nature, even if people don't always recognize it as mathematics. So as long as the theories of the universe remain logical, coherent mathematical structures, physicists believe that there's hope that we will understand them one day. And so far, that's been working. There's no guarantee it'll work forever.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.